Council members also received a copy of meeting notes of our meeting of May 8, 2019. I received no comments or corrections, so if there are none today, I'll entertain a motion to approve those meeting notes.
So moved.
Thank you, Leland. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Jeff. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? It's unanimous. We'll start with a research report from the Great Salt Lake technical team. As you know, by statute, they're serving an advisory capacity to us on scientific matters. And I've asked Jake Vanderlaan if he'd give us a brief report this morning.
So not exactly a research report, but an update on the tech team grants for 2020. So the committee to award those grants met a few weeks ago and awarded out grants. So for 2020, we had 8 hot topics that were recommended to the tech team. We received a total of 13 proposals related to those hot topics. So a total funding request of just about $570,000. The tech team has about $200,000 to award grants. So we selected five to fund through the tech team related to all those different hot topics, and then we had a 6th one that will be funded through separate Frank Whitey's funding through DNR. So the topics that were avoided were related to air quality and dust, including research from Janice Brainy at Utah State, quantifying Burlington Bay dust composition from source to sink. We also awarded a grant to Ed Hamill at Utah State, looking at metals and soils and plants in wetlands around Great Salt Lake. A couple of awards for the hot topic related to salt balance in the lake. Both to UGS, one to Elliot Jagniecki, and one to Stephen Kirby. I already mentioned Karen Kettering. Her wetland revegetation study is going to be funded from Frank Whitey's funding through DNR. Another study related to air quality and dust from Kevin Perry at the University of Utah. And that study is characterizing the future dust and heavy metals emissions from GSL. So like I said, that's a total of about $200,000 of research funding for the upcoming year. If you're interested in seeing some of the past research awards as well as this year's hot topics, you can do that through the Fortune Partner Statement's website. So that has our eight hot topics, as well as the proposals and a set of summaries for some of the 2019 projects. So, any questions on that?
Could you just scroll back to the hot topics again, please?
Sure. Yeah, so we got a pretty eclectic mix of topics recommended to us this year. Some new ones that we hadn't really considered in the past before, which was interesting to see. So.
What does Farmington Bay inundation mean?
Well, I'm not completely sure, to be honest. It was a topic that was recommended to us.
Neither am I.
My understanding is it's related to an idea of helping keep water elevation in the bay to protect from dust. But we didn't get a proposal that was sort of clearly directly related to that, although that topic was recommended.
Okay. Just curious.
Thanks.
Jake?
Yeah.
Is Karim Kentenbrink's Frank Mighty's work a continuation of what has been a part of what USU has been doing with Frank Mighty's?
Yeah, I think it's kind of the next step in her sort of pathway of research. And I think they're looking primarily now to restore and revegetate after removing frag.
And then Dr. Perry and dust on Grayson Lake, that's a continuation of work that he's been doing as
yes.
well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll just say that I believe the current administration is funded. We put that as a hot topic, but we always end up funding it out of our Grayson Lake frag mines.
Other questions or comments? Thank you, Jake. Appreciate that. All right, the next item on the agenda are some brief committee reports, status of council projects, and some updates. We'll start with the membership. Leland, the chair of the committee, and I appreciate all the effort he does to track people down and get them to respond.
We have the two open positions, one from Weber County and one from Salt Lake County. The Weber County position, a name has been submitted. They put the application in. We've had a little bit of delay from the governor's office of actually getting the appointment done. What they want in order to complete it, had some communication with them yesterday, and we're filling out everything else they need to do. That will be a county commissioner, most likely Gage Brewer, who was a former legislator just recently elected. That'll be well. On the Salt Lake County side, there is not a nomination yet. If you have a in with the Salt Lake County Council or the mayor's office and you want to encourage them to put a name forward, that would be wonderful. We contacted them and the governor's office said they're going to contact the county. But as of right now, we do not know of anybody whose name is being put forward.
Is there anything in the bylaws that precludes someone from who has served in the past to serving again?
No.
No.
Okay.
No, it just has to be nominated by the county because it's a county nominated position.
Right.
So, no, the answer to that is absolutely not.
Okay.
Everything else is in position. We have some that will be coming up. In the year or so, and those we'll have to deal with again with the governor's office because some of the ones who are in position are going to reach their two-term limit. And so the question will be from the governor's office, are we allowed to renominate that individual if they're the chosen one by that organization, or whether we have to go out and get an alternative name. So far, if it's a organizationally appointed one, they've allowed us to say, if the organization says, I still want this person, like a county, then that person has been allowed to be nominated for a third term. But generally, that's not the governor's office approach. They would like two terms and you're out. So we think we're okay. We'll find out.
Thank you, Lena. Appreciate your efforts there. Before we go to the next item on the agenda, I failed to go around the room and let people introduce themselves. Should we start at the table and we'll do the sideways and backwards?
Jeff Scott, Waxahachie County.
Randy Elliott, Davis County.
I didn't know that.
Joe Havas, Higgs Cracker, Minnesota.
Jake Vanderlaan, Division of Water Quality.
Dan Tuttle, Tula County.
Chris Montague, Nature Conservancy Conservation.
Leland Meyer, Sewer Folks.
Don Leonard with Brian Schiff Industry.
Jeff Richards, Migratory Bird Production Areas.
Laura Richard, Echo Northwest.
Mark Piper, Echo Northwest.
Mark Fulton, National Audubon.
Max Wampus, National Audubon.
Georgie Gregory, Great Salt Lake Audubon.
Heather Duff, Great Salt Lake Audubon.
Lynn DeFreitas, Friends of Great Salt Lake.
Andy Hill, Nature Conservancy.
Yvonne General, Legislative Clown Bucks.
Ryan Cotton from Division of Forestry, Fire and State Lands.
Laura Alt, Forestry, Fire and State Lands.
Jen Strickland, Division of Hazards.
Brian Doherty, Fire and State.
Corey Angroth, U.S. Geological Survey.
Christine Rumsey, USGS.
Chris Montague, Division of Public Services.
Craig Miller, Utah Resources.
Ben Clark, Law College Facilities.
Brian Nixon, Martin Nixon. Tim Hoss, Brian Schiff Industry.
Candace Austin, Fair Water Resources.
Jeff Lukowski, Rio Tinto.
Andre Forrest, Great Sewer District.
Jack Ray, Utah Water Health Association.
Steve Erickson, Utah Water Council.
Nick Scatter, Utah Rivers Council.
Ben Wolfram, Water Quality.
Brian Dixon, Bridgman, Audubon Society.
Rob Burman, U.S. Bank Newsroom.
Tom Tripp, Tula County.
Jamie Martin, Forestry, Fire and State Lands. Pam Prin, Division of Wildlife Resources. Ashley Hasky, Division of Wildlife.
Hello back there, Darrell. Well, thank you, welcome to all of you. Note that our July meeting is traditionally our least well-attended meeting, so thank you for being here today. The next item on the agenda is we've asked Laura Hall to give us an update on the Salinity Advisory Committee's activity. Laura, please.
All right, so we put an RFP out. We started the Salinity Advisory Committee in 2017. Some of you are members of that committee. It's to address the closing of the culverts and the new breach that Union Pacific Railroad put in. It's adaptive management within that breach. And after 5 years, if we want to adaptively manage that breach, I guess is how you say that, I don't know. Then that falls on the Division of Forestry, Fire and State Lands to make that decision and fund that. And we thought we should have a committee of scientists to figure out what that looks like. So we convened a committee, CH2ML, or what do they call that?
Jacobs.
Put that together. They met in 2017. We haven't met since. We put out an RFP to have a consultant put that group back together and facilitate meetings as necessary. The RFP closed, I believe, at 2 p.m. yesterday, and we'll evaluate that RFP next week and make a decision. And I believe, Don, are you going to be on that committee or have somebody appointed to?
So Forestry, Fire, and State Lands contacted me and indicated they'd like a representative of the advisory council to participate in that selection committee. If there's a member of the council who'd like to do so, I'd welcome it. Volunteer. If not, I'll fill that role.
There could be cookies if that.
Laura, you may have to say no. Anyone on the council want to participate in that selection committee?
Don't everybody jump up at once.
All right, I'll make sure we're covered, Laura.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of Laura, by the way? Okay, great, thank you. The next item on the agenda is an update on a council project that we received the report at our last meeting. And I thought, in fact, the rest of our meeting is in regards to some council projects and presentations. I thought I'd just remind people of a little bit of background. As you know, we were created as a council in 2010, and it was the result of some recommendations from prior Governor Huntsman. Created a group that had made some recommendations about a structure of an advisory council going forward. And those recommendations actually gave the council some decision-making authority over actions that would impact the lake and some funding, et cetera. But by the time it got through the legislature and approved by the governor, the structure was somewhat different. It was an advisory council without funding and without that kind of decision-making authority. Some folks were a bit disappointed by that outcome. But Leland Myers was our chairman at the time, and under his leadership, we decided that there was still a great role we could play, and that would principally be by informing the debate, by trying to make sure that decision makers had the information they needed to make good decisions. And so 2 years after we formed, we issued our first two reports. The first one was an assessment of Lake Health. There hadn't been a comprehensive assessment done prior to that. And we convened a science advisory committee and had SWAC and a facilitator help work through the process, spent a lot of time, and issued a report about the health of the lake, and also issued an executive summary of that. Shortly thereafter, we issued what's, I think, become our most quoted report, and that is a report on the economic significance of Great Salt Lake to the state of Utah. That also came out in 2012, and it's the source of the number $1.32 billion. And it came up, it's an incredible, accurate, well-quoted report because the industries around the lake willingly opened their books to a third-party accounting firm as long as they aggregated the data and didn't disclose individual company data. So it wasn't an extrapolation of health or labor statistics as some prior reports had been. It was the actual financial records of companies, and so that we know the report is accurate and credible. And again, like I say, it's the source of the $1.32 billion economic impact number. Shortly after that, we determined that there were a lot of research projects that needed to be conducted on the lake, and there were fewer dollars than there were projects, so to help make an alignment, we prepared a report of research priorities, research database for priorities, and I'm happy to report that since that time, most of those high priorities are either underway or have been completed, and some of the others as well. Skipping forward, then we stepped into some funding issues at the legislature, and Dan Tuttle deserves a lot of our thanks for teaming up with Forestry Fire and the Department of Natural Resources and going to the state and getting funding to create the Integrated Water Resource Management Model, now called GSLM, and then subsequent to that to get funding for Phragmites eradication. It may have been a bit of a lofty goal to call it eradication. We maybe should have called it reduction or some other term, but you know, we were young and untainted by the expectations of the world. So. Then after that, we updated our research topics database. In 2017, we compiled a report called Water for Salt, Great Salt Lake. At the time, the issue of the water levels for the lake was coming to the forefront, and we invited people to submit potential strategies to address that issue, and 72 strategies were submitted. We prioritized them among ourselves and have advocated the higher priorities. Last year, we worked long and hard, thanks to in great part to Jeff Richards, who I think was the initial author of a letter to the governor asking for a statewide policy to address declining lake levels. And that was followed up by a concurrent resolution, HCR 10, is that right? HCR 10, that was passed in this session of legislature, seeking recommendations to make sure water levels are maintained at the Great Salt Lake. That leads me to this year's reports. Last fall, we commissioned two reports. Well, the first of those reports was completed and given at our May meeting, and that report is entitled Consequences of Drying Lake Systems Around the World. AECOM was the consulting firm we selected to prepare that report, and they concluded that there were as many as 25 terminal saline lakes around the world that were declining or drying up, 8 of which shared significant characteristics with the Great Salt Lake. And so at our May meeting, AECOM presented that report. And at that meeting, we decided, consistent with our past reports, a lot of people don't read the 90-page reports. And so we've been preparing executive summaries, standalone executive summaries for these reports. And at our last meeting, commission to do that, us to do that. I'm happy to let you know that in fact it's been completed. Jake, would you pass those out to everyone?
Maybe you want to make one pass along here. Jake, pass them out.
Great thanks to a couple of people to help with the logistics of this. Marcel, where are you? Thank you very much. Marcel been very involved in getting this done. And the Nature Conservancy as well. Thank you to you for your help and support in getting this done. You'll notice that it is, I think, an excellent summary of the report we received in May. The inside front cover talks about the 25 significant saline lakes in decline and the 8 terminal lakes that share important characteristics with the Great Salt Lake. If you look at the inside right-hand page, you see some highlights of some of the consequences of drying lake systems around the world. But I think the real value of the summary is if you open it up and you get the spreadsheet, if you will, of consequences of drying lake systems. You get the description of the lake in the first column, the cause and extent of the drying in the second column. And then we asked our consultant to address three different broad topics: economic consequences, social / health consequences, and environmental consequences. And I think this is a great summary of those consequences from the report. And the back page draws the conclusion that fortunately it's not too late to take steps for the Great Salt Lake to avoid these kinds of consequences and problems that are occurring around the world. It's our intention to make sure that this executive summary gets in the hand of every member of the legislature, key legislative staff, agency managers, and others who are interested in the health of the Great Salt Lake. So any questions about that? Okay, we have, thanks again, Marcel, Nature Conservancy, for your help with that. Appreciate that. So today, we have a report that we commissioned that's near final. We selected through a process Econ Northwest to perform an assessment of potential cost of declining water levels of Great Salt Lake. So we've looked at the cost in our prior report of drying lakes around the world. Now we want to look at what the potential costs are of a drying Great Salt Lake. And like I say, Econ West is completing that report. We've invited Mark Buckley and Laura Marshall of Econ West to present the findings of that report. They're backed up by Brian Nicholson and Susan Martin of Martin Nicholson. Before we go to that, we have one other project that we launched at our last meeting. And as you recall, we were integral in getting the funding and the design of the Integrated Water Research Resource Management Model. And that model was prepared by the predecessor to Jacobs, I think, before the merger happened. We wanted to run some scenarios through that model. And so we funded that activity, and that's almost complete as well. And at our September meeting, Jeff Denblaker of Jacobs will be here to share those scenarios with us and to talk about other potential scenarios that could be run through the model to tell us what the impacts of current or future actions and decisions might be on the lake. Should be a very useful tool and an interesting report, I think. Now, to get that done in a fairly quick, short period of time, we needed some special expertise, and Leland agreed to chair a subcommittee to help get that done. I'd call on Leland to see if you have anything to add about the description or where we're at on that project.
Well, the project is almost complete. They've got preliminary data out. Well, project is basically complete. It's now getting the final report format finished and then getting your presentation on it. The modeling, quite honestly, is close to depressing. I mean it really doesn't. We assessed several different scenarios. First off, there was a baseline scenario, which assumed that nothing changes. No people come in, no climate variability, everything's just like it is today. And that keeps us down low in the lake. Doesn't give us a lot of potential based on the length of the model again, and a lot of other parameters that give it, it's a model, so you know, if you're a modeler, you know that all models lie, right? So the basis of the model is as good as we can get it, and there's this baseline which says we're still not gonna have a major recovery. Potential, something radical happens to be periodic recoveries, but not looking like a major recovery at Lynn Lake level. Then there, the next scenario was what they called the future baseline. So you took the baseline conditions, same kind of water usage that we have today, but added to it climate variability and change, and also added to it population growth. And that shows a significant decline in lake level. We're talking several feet, 3-4 feet plus or minus, based on how you view the model. And then the next scenario was, let's put in there a scenario that closely follows the state water strategy that was developed. And that shows that it's not so bad as the baseline, but not as good as if there were no growth or anything else occurring. The fourth scenario was, significant conservation. It includes significant reduction in turf, grass in the municipal and industrial sectors, significant conservation in other ways. So there's significant conservation. It also includes a certain degree of conservation at the agricultural level. And if that occurred, that keeps us fairly similar to what we'd be today if there were no growth or anything else. It doesn't improve it beyond that, but it does keep us on a trajectory that's not in a catastrophic area. And then the final scenario is, and if it gets a bit warmer, and if you do a lot more population, not a lot, but some more, and if you don't change the water use levels, what happens? And that's catastrophic in terms of the lake. We've asked the chart to be prepared, and there are bands on the chart that show where we think the lake is healthy based on the Great Salt Lake Health Summary Report, and also based on the Great Salt Lake Master Plan. Those bands very seldom get into the good category. We stay in marginal or poor category, and if you don't do anything in terms of conservation or change of behavior, and it gets a bit warmer, then it's catastrophic category. And so this report should be done. We'll have a report on it. But the primer is, it's now or never in terms of getting something done to affect the change. Because if we don't, the lake is going to be in continual decline. And it'll be to a point where mineral extraction and everything else is going to be very difficult, as well as the birds having a place to land and food for them, and all the other important functions the lake performs. So should be out, very important. It'll be another one of our nice glossies that we'll be able to hand out. Hopefully help people understand how important it is today to take action and have an action plan that carries us out for that period of time to 2060 in order to continue to resolve the issues and save the lake in a very real sense.
Dan, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So did that include the Bear River?
It does.
No, it doesn't. The scenarios don't include diversions.
The scenarios, the Bear River is included, the Bear River project is included as part of the overall model. But the scenarios, I think it does include the Bear River in it.
The diversion?
It includes the Bear River, but it doesn't include construction of the diversion of the lakes or the reservoirs if the conservation plans are followed. But if you don't do the conservation plan, that worst case scenario, I believe, does include complete construction of the Bear River.
Well,
to leave that question a little bit of suspense, give you a reason to come back in September, right? Other questions or comments? Thanks, Leland. I know you did a lot of work and effort, and I'm looking forward to work later in the year, September meeting. Okay, now let's move to the presentation of the report titled Assessment of Potential Costs of Declining Water Levels in Great Salt Lake. Dr. Mark Buckley and Laura Marshall, I think, are going to be the principal presenters here. Welcome and thank you for your work.
Thanks, Don. Thanks, everyone, for having us.
You need to speak quite loudly.
Talk about, okay.
It's a big open room.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's a big room and a nice sized crowd, so we appreciate having you over here. I know you all bring your areas of expertise to this question, and I think that highlights what this project was about, where we were trying to synthesize the existing information that's out there, this growing body of science, and see where we can translate it into this question that Don laid out before us that we were charged with. What are the costs, what are the consequences of declining lake levels? So as we can take the science that exists here at Great Salt Lake, as well as from elsewhere, the literature highlights a fair amount of the useful information from other situations. What can we do that translate that information all the way through to economic consequences? So our firm, we're economists. I lead the natural resource practice. Laura and I worked on this closely, but we had several scientists, Brian over here, Brian Nicholson, and his colleagues, Mark, help us, as well as several of you in this room were able to help us with your research or interviews, meetings, and all that. So much appreciation. A little bit of quick context, what we're trying to do when I say economic analysis is look at what the science tells us about how these complex systems' impacts of changing lake levels will translate through to changes in values of goods and services that people care about, market and non-market. And in some cases, those goods and services have important roles in the regional economy, and we can look at what the output is. The 2012 bioeconomic study that Don described is a centerpiece of the data that we provide for this. We did not recreate or reinvent any of that work. We're applying it to a slightly different question, but generally building on that and then taking the remainder of the science and seeing where we can take that science fully out to effects that can be quantified in terms of a change in the supply, quality, and quantity of things that people care about, and then what is that value decided. And we tend to have to do that work in a piece-by-piece manner so that we can apply the different sorts of valuation methodologies depending on whether the value is a market or non-market kind of good. So I'm quickly acknowledging that this is work that came from a lot of different folks, and we're the ones who get to present the final package. So stupid. So what we're doing here is we're looking at declining lake levels. And originally when we came to this project, we were going to be keeping our eyes out for important thresholds. And there are certain thresholds that matter for certain infrastructure, for certain biological phenomena. But in general, we're looking at more of a trend and how some of the large steps in declining lake conditions are going to manifest. The small incremental changes, we have less confidence in what those will mean. And I think folks in the room understand that we've got quite a bit of seasonal fluctuation. So we're trying to talk about big changes in the lake. What's going to happen when we see some dramatic changes moving down below levels that have been seen or observed in recent history. Now, as we know, this is a complex system. Building from the matrix that was developed in previous work, trying to systematically move through all of the changes that will occur in different biophysical, chemical, socioeconomic systems, where we can translate those effects all the way through to final goods and services. So this chart is a nice summary that we think helps to identify some of the key direct effects of declining lake levels in that top row, and how those initial effects translate through in direct or indirect ways, and even in compounding ways, to outcomes that are going to impose costs on the regional community and regional economy. So these are some of the key categories that we end up moving into: water management, water supply, costs for recreation, ski resorts in particular, property value, capturing some of the industry effects, existence value, mineral extraction, a variety of recreation effects in different ways, some of the direct management costs of resources around the lake, including invasives with phragmites. So again, this is sort of a compilation of the science translated with a focus on the lens of what are the economic implications of the best science available today. I mean, we understand that that science is changing constantly, and with the grants that this council is funding, the research that it's funding, that's going to improve over time. So I see this question as sort of a living process that you're going to be able to build on in the same way the bioeconomics study provided a nice solid foundation. We're hoping that this information can be described and used in a way that helps to keep that story going. We also recognize that part of the information purpose for this is the policy context and thinking about what are the trade-offs. And ultimately, in economics, this sort of work, what we're trying to do is provide information to inform decision-making involving scarce resources. What are the trade-offs at play? This study, though, is not some comprehensive benefit-cost analysis. We're not saying Bear River project benefits are this much, the cost it imposes are this much. This is just looking at the consequences of the lake declining and not an investigation of the value of the decisions or other uses where there are direct uses that are leading to those changes. Certainly there are changes that are being driven by non-anthropogenic phenomena, and we don't go into that. There's a little bit of that science background, but this is the focus on economics. So, is there anything else you would add to this piece of it? So Laura led all of the detail analysis. So I'm gonna let her, she's gonna take over and describe some of the specific analyses. We don't have time to go into what we did for each piece. Again, this was a synthesis of existing information and application of the available economic data that we could use to understand the value and the consequences of this information. But each category of effect and cost is sort of its own study. So this will be sort of high level, but I think we'll have time for plenty of conversation and questions afterwards.
Yeah, and that being said, so we focus on the monetized cost for this presentation just because the methods are important to understand some of the monetized, but we also have quantified costs where there wasn't sufficient information to monetize it, and then also non-quantified costs. And I just want to say, just because we're spending a little bit more time in the monetized costs, that does not reflect the value of the importance of them. Just because some things can't be monetized but still can have that many huge effects. So going over the monetized costs that we do have, the largest one is informed a little bit by the bioeconomic study that they did based on the mineral extraction industry. That is an extremely large economic driver of the lake. And we did inflate these values to $2019 just to be able to compare them, so that looks a little bit different, that's why. And then also similarly with job losses for the mineral extraction industry. Other monetized costs include the brine shrimp industry, also from the bioeconomics report. And then some of the recreation information from the bioeconomics report, and then supplemented with the ski information and the recreational use values, which we'll discuss. And then lastly, health costs as well are monetized. And when we roll these up, there's a little bit of caution in totaling these numbers because there are temporal considerations with these effects. So they don't all come into effect at the same time, which we'll discuss on each one. So the first one with the mineral extraction industry, Leland kind of set us up well here when I was listening when you were speaking about that. Even though there are some water rights here, we know that as the lake retreats, there are millions of dollars in costs that can be incurred for regrading, repumping, that sort of thing. And then these water rights are just for the lake itself, and so they can't make a call on any of the upstream water rights, which means that if there are currently under the current system, so if there are issues with obtaining or fulfilling water rights, that's confined to the lake. So based on that, we have the $1.3 billion in total output, which represents the total value of the industry. And it's unclear at what extent, and it will vary by company, when that is realized and those costs are incurred, plus those regrading costs as well.
Laura, I think you could see up a little bit.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Is there a microphone on you?
There might be one on the podium.
Should we ask them that? Is it worth it? Okay.
I'll say advertising for the report. Interviewing folks from the industry, we tried to capture some of the information that helps tell the story about how that loss would manifest, because it isn't all at once. We have to see a very dramatic loss of total lake area and volume to see that fully realized, but there are some good stories out there in terms of what some of the incremental effects will have on operations, salinity, infrastructure, access to the water, etc.
Has this been in our room?
Yeah.
Oh, perfect. Okay. Don't talk about that too, which is nice. So for the brine shrimp industry, it's a little bit different because we have a bit of a clear picture for the entire industry on when the cost might be realized. And it obviously comes down to salinity. So we have this graphic which Frank together for us, data over time on salinity. And the takeaway here is just that there is a pretty clear relationship between elevation and salinity, and that's what's been seen. The term elevation for it backs this up as well. As with lower elevation, you can expect salinity increases. Now, brine shrimp on 16% salinity is where reproductive issues begin to occur. I always have to be careful about how I characterize this. But the reproductive issues could be very severe, and so not just for the brine shrimp industry, but for the birds as well that rely on them. Once you hit that threshold and above, which is what we see in the North Arm already, there could be pretty serious implications to the industry and the environment. So again, using information from the bioeconomics report, here is how we developed these costs. And those are $67 million per year. And I should say all of these costs are annualized. So when you think about the costs that would be over a long period of time, so we think we can like level, we're going to be more than just a year. Next one is health costs. And this I was glad to see on the 2020 research priorities that were shared earlier. One of the first ones, the air quality impacts, because if there was one study I would recommend after doing this research, it would be on the air quality effects and health effects. Because dust is associated with a lot of adverse health outcomes. So we assumed, based on research from Dr. Skiles and Carly and Fernandez, that about 7 to 30% of the dust loads are actually going to be very solid. So taking the geographies for Cache, Davis, Salt Lake, and Weber counties, basically totaling up how much dust do we see in a year, and assigning either that low in 7% or the high in 30% to the scenarios. And then we have values from the literature from Muller and Mendelsohn, some researchers who have calculated the cost based on the lifetime of these pollutants, so we can come up with a cost pretty easily there.
Do you want to see how those costs, sort of health costs,
Yeah, so it's both. So you'll see for PM2.5, it's a higher health cost. We have the 2,600 there. And that's reflective of the fact that PM2.5 is smaller, so it gets into your system easier and causes more adverse health outcomes. And then they're based on cost of illness. So both value statistical life for morbidity and then cost of illness, which is healthcare costs, absenteeism from work, that sort of thing. So we relied on some information from Perry, who has the estimates for how much of the lake is boiling dust, to come up with, okay, assuming those proportions hold in a dry future lake scenario, this is about what we would expect. The interesting thing with health costs is that these are actually already happening right now. So these are future costs of lake level declines, but also because Great Salt Lake is contributing to those health loads, we are seeing this cost every day. And those of you who live here have seen the dust storms, and maybe your friends and family have been able to speak to that. Okay. And the other thing too with this is these costs often impact children, the elderly, vulnerable populations, so there's a little bit of a distributional issue here as well. And next is recreation. With recreation, we have kind of a shout out to the GIS guy who made a lot of these figures that you're seeing in the report here. But with this, the recreation kind of depends on the type of recreation. And again, we rely on bioeconomic information here a little bit. Burning and deafening, those will sort of depend on the location and the water rights and the extent to species that we don't totally know, but assuming there would be pretty large impacts there. Saline and voting, you talked to me about that work, I believe, right?
Right, there are issues with access that people I think are probably already seeing quite a bit of loss both of access and use of the marina and those sorts of issues. So what we try to do here is understand a little bit more about the kinds of levels and effects, including invasives on some of these kinds of recreation activities and what the conditions are where we lose total access for certain kinds of recreation.
Yeah, but we do expect continued recreation even at a pretty significant level declines, even though access points will likely be reduced. So kind of calculating, going through each one of those and seeing, okay, how much do we expect, what are the current levels, which we took also from bioeconomics and some of our original research. And so this is recreation spending only, and it's assuming about a 50% decrease in visitation, which we think is probably actually a conservative estimate, depending on the extent of like levels. And there are definitely hundreds of jobs associated with this 575, using the information from bioeconomics, and about $89 million in total output for economic contribution. Snow recreation. So this is one that bioeconomics didn't look at. They just looked at the values of the lake. We relied on the 5.1 to 8.4% of snowpack from the lake effect. So based on that, and also the reduced albedo, although we didn't quantize the reduced albedo portion, which will increase snow melt because the snow is absorbing more energy. So based on that and the information from the literature, it project up to 30,000 reduction in visits to the ski resorts, and the spending associated with that is up to $9.6 million per year. And you want to talk about the marketing piece of that? Okay, I'll put it together. So Dr. Skiles in her research pointed this out as well, but the lake effect is kind of part of the marketing of skiing in Northern Utah, and so if you lose that to what extent, are you losing that tourism associated with that marketing?
Awesome. Yeah, one of the points that's come up for us a few times, sort of perceived effects in society versus actual effects when there's uncertainty around this, and how do you value that? In economics, we tend to care about what's actually going to influence behavior. And so people think, for example, that the dust, that the lake is this primary driver of dust for health effects. Or if there's a perception that the lake is highly responsible for quality of snow and skiing. Even if there isn't a huge health effect, or even if there isn't a huge lake effect, if that's been the story of the marketing, people aren't going to come on vacation. Maybe people won't want to live here, businesses might not choose to site here because of that perception. So the deeper we dig into this, and a lot of the science that your group and others are funding, it's helping us understand some of the realities of the incremental effects of dust on snowpack, on health, of the lake on snowpack overall. That at times isn't necessarily as important as what the public's going to actually believe. So I think that's important.
So the last two recreation slides have been about spending more than the lake and the ski resorts, but there's also this other economic component that we look at, which will come up just confusing and more by providing the graph here. But it's essentially this fact that people value these experiences more than just by what they pay for it. And so to capture the cost of losing it, you need to capture that additional value, which is represented by the gray triangle here above the extent of the expenditures. We don't need to go into that too much, but just know that based on those values which come from Forest Service, kind of the industry standard moving through there, about $37 million.
Yeah, I'll just add quickly, this is based in general on travel cost-based methods where we can look at how many trips people take, depending on how expensive a trip for a certain kind of recreational cost. And generally, people have higher costs, take fewer trips, and people with lower costs usually live closer and take more trips. So we can draw a demand curve. And we know what the actual expenditures are. Bioeconomics dug into that piece, but this is getting more what the actual net benefits to society are. So if you choose to go to the lake, choose to go skiing, the value of it is worth at least as much as what you're paying, but probably a fair amount more. So this consumer surplus piece is really the efficiency to society. What are the benefits minus the cost that we're talking about? And usually this is where we would like to focus an economic analysis, where there's a real value contribution to society, but spending, jobs, those sorts of things have a little more resonance and can seem more tangible. These numbers are a little bit lower, but I would also want to comment that These are just the values of the trips. It doesn't capture the larger decisions people make to live here, to stay here, to have a business here, to expand businesses because of these recreation opportunities. And that's important to keep in mind. We struggle with that sometimes, and it can make it look like the tourist trip is more valuable because they're spending more. But it's not capturing those more important sort of fundamental decisions that might drive overall population and the population sort of composition. As we see increasingly that amenities, quality of life are a driver for attracting skilled workforces, businesses that can choose where they want to stay, and quality of life, the environmental quality, obviously were the key selling points for the entire state as a whole. So to the extent that there is information perception that those recreation and environmental quality opportunities are going to decline, that can affect larger macroeconomic systems for the state and the region as a whole.
Thanks, Mark. And so another component of this, which we, for those of you who've seen the exam this summer, we actually pulled this out after we sent that to you, the mitigation costs would make it so that some of the health costs potentially, some of the habitat costs that we'll talk about later, maybe wouldn't occur. So at Owens Lake Consultancy in California, they've done mitigation there over the 20 to 30 years that they've been doing it. It's been billions of dollars that they've spent on this. At Owens Lake, it was air quality based, so violations of the Clean Air Act. And so using those numbers, you get a per acre per square mile figure there on the slide. And then assuming that only the amount that would be dust entirely the scenario, it could be minimized to millions of dollars per acre in those mitigation costs. And it's unclear the viability of who would pay that, but just something to also call out.
And again, does this make sense? This is controlling the dust and the dust load.
And habitat creation. So that brings us next. I mentioned there were monetized costs and quantified costs where we couldn't monetize because we either didn't know the dollar value or the extent of the cost. One of the important ones of these is the impacts to the population.
Sure. So one of the complicated issues that comes up with these kinds of studies is where there's an incremental contribution. And so we have an idea of how valuable, there's sort of ecological, biological values of migratory birds beyond sort of the direct sort of human-based values of existence, bird watching, those sorts of things, complex ecological effects. And then the fact that these are migratory birds, it means that there are benefits outside the boundaries of the state. And this is one category where, in particular, I think the benefits are much more diffused geographically. What we do have, though, is some information on how much people, on average, households have shown their willingness to pay and fund programs that support migratory birds. And so this number here is across the state, migratory bird populations as a whole, around 28 million. We understand that this region isn't the only contributor to migratory bird populations, but it is difficult to understand what the full contribution would be of, in a negative sense, if you lost it, especially given the unique characteristics, the food habitat characteristics that don't really have substitutes around here necessarily. So this is one where it's difficult to narrow in on it. I think the best way to interpret this number is that the actual value just to Utahns is probably less than this, but the total value, if we look out beyond the boundaries of the state, is probably quite a bit larger.
Yeah, and the next one on here is the invasive species cost. So we talked with Dr. Kettenring, I believe, is his name, to try and understand if the farm IDs would increase or decrease with lake levels. We didn't feel comfortable saying for certain that they would increase, but when you have the water coming in and out, there are definitely possibilities to see increased farm IDs, which we know goes across the treatment costs there. Similarly with property value projections, the literature suggests that, and this is kind of related to the health impacts, so based on the dust, there's definitely a decrease in property values when you increase dust load. So from the literature, we can see what some of those values are, but it'd be interesting to do a study here to see that. And then the last one is water management costs. And so this is more related to the lake effect and El Nino, because if you are affecting snowpack and water is stored in snowpack here, how does that affect those downstream water users?
I guess I'll add that the best way to think about the value of this last piece is what are those incremental investments? What's the Bear River Project going to cost? if you needed to replace that natural storage effect, what will that be? The other way to think about it is what is the value of sort of the marginal, the sort of last of water that's being used. So I think this is a very dynamic value at different levels, different scarcities. Basically, the more scarce water gets, the more valuable it gets, and the more dramatic that cost will be.
And then lastly, the non-quantified costs, just didn't have sufficient information to make much of a determination, but we think are still important. One of which is decreased agricultural yields from soil salinity and dust. Other one also from dust for operations. There definitely have been slight cancellations because of dust. So salt lake contributes to more intense and more frequent dust storms. We can see costs there. One of the significant costs as well, predator control, fencing, that sort of thing, when you get the land bridges to some of the islands. And the last two Mark touched on already a little bit, but this idea about quality of life, so, and then also the cultural and spiritual values. So Great Salt Lake is obviously the namesake for Salt Lake City. There's a lot of identity tied with the lake, and also just Utah's reputation and basically what they live dry out at. Those are reputational costs, but also can translate into real costs if businesses don't want to locate here because they have quality so bad. Talented people don't want to move here. So based on that, those are the costs that we analyzed. If you see anything that you're missing, please let us know. And these costs will vary. These kind of represent the total potential cost based on our mandate for this study. And so they'll depend on legal and policy decisions, especially with mitigation and water rate questions.
Last thing I would just add, though, is after taking the science and trying to translate it out into other effects, get a more comprehensive sense of the economic consequences of declining lake levels. We see that the quantifiable industry-based values from before do tend to dominate and are larger than the quantifiable effects of some of these other more non-market-based effects. I think it's important, though, not to discount them too much because we do have this complex regional cultural quality of life issue that's at play that's hard to isolate. So I think in the report we have an extensive sort of background on the science for each of these pieces and try to tell the story. But the take-home final dollar values, still we're talking about billions of dollars a year.
Yeah, I'll say that's where I think we can really add value with this report is a lot of the narrative, actually it's a long report, but a lot of the narrative for these specific sections will inform some of the more incremental costs and incremental changes that might occur at the climate level. So with that, I think we can take any questions on how much time we have.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
So with Owens Lake in California, there was a great big lawsuit. Probably still is a great big lawsuit. So did you put that into the equation on this at all? How much the lawsuit's going to cost?
No, that's not included in this cost equation. So yes, additional lawsuit administration costs like that would definitely be there.
Yeah, the liability issue, just to make a quick point. We do these sorts of studies all the time. The actual distribution of the financial cost. Oh, sorry. I was going to say, sometimes the distribution of the costs and benefits are quite different than what they might appear to be on the categories. Wildfire is a good example where we might see that the costs look like they're homeowners, but if there's a liable party utility that's a good target from a legal context, that might be where the actual final dollars end up. So we're not putting any sort of actual distribution of where those costs would be born.
Okay.
But in your summary, you do have the landscape mitigation costs, which are typical of the lawsuit, which resulted from the lake where they had to go back in on an annual basis and mitigate for the dust problems that were being created. And so I didn't see it quite in your presentation, but that's a huge number, between $191 to $610 million a year. Okay, so that's where your lawsuit comes in primarily. That's what would happen.
I might say another way to think about this is, even if there wasn't a lawsuit, this has demonstrated the willingness to pay for society in general in this sort of context elsewhere. So it's Another way to think about it is these would be avoided costs, and our best way of understanding a monetary value equivalent to that avoided cost, if that case came, if that situation arose. We don't want to suggest that we're implying there's any sort of specific lawsuit and predicting some kind of outcome. This is more our best way to understand what some of those financial implications could be.
In regard to dust, at some point the lake will become saturated. At that point, what's left behind is going to be solid crusted. There will be no dust from those sections. Did you consider that aspect?
Yeah, we were talking about that quite a bit in terms of how long would these costs manifest and to what extent. And Laura can speak to this more and probably Marcel as well, but they've been spending this money for over 20 years there already, so maybe we can assume that it might be at least a 20-year cost schedule, and there isn't any expectation yet that those costs are going to go away anytime soon. I don't know if anyone else knows more about that.
Yeah, Kevin Perry would be really good one to talk to about that. We relied on his research based on the 11% of dry lake that's currently blowing dust. So even for the portions that have declined in more recent years, we are still seeing dust coming from those sources.
You should consider the whole lake bed or just the south lake bed.
Well, we only assume mitigation on the areas that would be dust sources, based
so
on his work.
What about the north arm?
I guess
it's already saturated in present salt.
Yeah, I think that's what Kevin Perry's research efforts.
Joe, you have a question?
I recall at the Friends Issues Forum, the last Issues Forum, there was a presentation on lake effect contribution to snowpack. I recall was the 5 to 8% contribution. That was over a period of decades on average, if I recall that presentation well. Any one year though, it could be a much higher contributor. So if you don't have the atmospheric river, the Pineapple Express bringing the Pacific moisture in, the velocity of the snowpack, you can always rely on at least a base level northwest winds contributing to the snowpack to be a much higher percentage in mean years, and which would have catastrophic or near-term impacts to the ski resorts. That doesn't seem to come out. I think there's opportunity, to highlight those lean years and the negative consequences.
That's a good point. Do we have that?
No, I don't think we do.
Okay, now I understand what you're saying, that there's sort of this base level that's maintained by the lake effect to some extent, so it keeps those worst years from being worse than they're going to be, where the resorts might not even open. And that is sort of the catastrophic level that we didn't go to of if a resort doesn't open completely. And we've seen that elsewhere. I don't think I've heard about that happening here before, but plenty of other places in the West.
If you look at it over 4 or 5 decades versus you did, then it gets diluted. And I think there's a lot of opportunity.
Other questions? Steve, are you talking with your hands or raising your hands? Go ahead.
Okay, so you've got the final number, right? Is that based on the threshold level of the lake, as I assume, right? So what's the threshold level of the lake, is that?
So I would describe that as the average annual cost when the fullest costs were being realized, which is granted a little bit confusing, but based on this is what the potential highest cost will be, but because there's always a temporal issue, we didn't want to say, okay, your potential cost over 20 years, when these events will happen is pretty unclear at this point. So that's how I would characterize them as the average annual cost when the highest cost is occurring.
And meaning when you have that full cost. And so in the report, we talk about some of the incremental costs on the way to that fullest cost, but basically what's the worst case scenario for these factors? And some of those, it doesn't mean the lake is lost. It means that the consequence that science allows us to quantify right now is fully realized.
And
these
threshold
blueberries,
so for mineral extraction, it may come specific depending on when the overgrade and change of the pumping, the branch industry, when salinities begin to such an extent, when populations might experience really adverse impacts from diseases and also habitat, that sort of thing. So the two sort of areas, I wouldn't say that we should think of these all as a
issue. Is there any
there a reason on this table you don't include the landscape mitigation costs?
Yes, so we actually took that off a little bit last minute, so my apologies there. But the landscape mitigation costs really are a little bit separate just because you wouldn't have this kind of health cost potentially if you were mitigating the solar dust.
You wouldn't have what?
Such high health costs, for example, if you were mitigating for some of the dust.
So there'd be
some double counting. So we didn't want to add it in this item.
So there'd be double counting. There's
yeah,
a little too much double counting that.
You could mitigate it.
But you could also think of it as a way to substitute.
Well, I mean, your increased health cost is 6 to 22 million. The mitigation cost is 191 to 610 million. That's a massive difference.
Well, but there's also the property value piece. So the dust could also be impacting property values. So that's something that would make more sense to be spending that money to do mitigation.
In my humble opinion, it ought to be included in that if we're going to put it in the executive summary. If you're making a presentation, it needs to be up there too.
Other questions, comments?
So again, in this case, I'd be interested to see what is the direct cost and indirect cost based on the lake level. Like if it goes to the 4190 or it goes to 4200, then what would the implication, with respect to those numbers? And also, even if we are at the lake level, how long do you sustain it? If it goes for 5 years or 10 years, those are the so many questions that as the general audience are going to be able to know. You are saying the worst case scenario, we don't know what the worst case means.
Future cost potential. I mean, we still can recreate out there, right?
Yep.
Even though we can get out there a little bit less, we still have duck clubs and we still have areas for it. These are catastrophic at the end of something going on, and we still can extract minerals. So if the level can be stabilized, you can maintain all of these economic benefits and these losses don't occur.
Unless the health care goes up.
Well, the health care would be an increase over where we're at today, or where we're, or are we defining that as a loss entirely? I'm assuming this is, if it gets worse kind of number, not where we're at today number.
Yeah, I would say the other positive way to look at this information is whenever you're looking at research for unprecedented conditions or outcomes, you're worried about these thresholds and these sort of cataclysmic outcomes. But we didn't find anything like that in science. We didn't find these very defined thresholds where you get past that point, the lake is worthless and that those are our bigger terms. This is more incremental and gradual, and across the different effects, it seems to vary quite a bit in terms of what kinds of changes. So basically, the lake is not likely to be a lost cause anytime soon. I'll say that much. And every incremental dollar that you can spend as a society or invest in the lake would have a positive return. And every avoided reduction would have in lake level would have a positive return as well. So I think that's a positive thing. It's not, you've got to go out and spend $20 billion if you're going to get any benefit. It's every little bit helps. And there isn't something, some cliff that's just around the corner that's going to make this, all this effort worthless.
What you just said, is that summarized in the report as well? Or could it be?
In the report, we're usually sort of cautious about how far we go with policy implications, but we can work with Marcel and council and what they'd like us to say about that. Happy to.
Others?
Okay, well, thank you. And we'll be around if you have more questions, and hopefully the report's useful.
And copy. All right, well, thank you. The next, we would expect to finalize this report in the next couple of weeks, I think. And we'll send out an electronic version of the final report as well as an executive summary for that. Okay, next on the agenda is a public comment period. Let me get an idea of how many people, if any, want to make comments during the public comment period so I know how to divide it up. Raise your hand if you have something you want to share. And Marcel, I'm not going to give you the full 10 minutes, but fire away.
I just was going to mention, maybe for the next meeting, it might be worth talking about the draft Watershed Council legislation that's being discussed, just to get people's attention, since that includes a Great Salt Lake Watershed as well. Watershed Council legislation.
Any other comments?
I think they'll go. Yeah.
All right, you just say the same minute.
Thank you.
Next item on the agenda is member recommendations and actions. In terms of topics you'd like to address, issues you're interested in, presentations of future meetings.
Sir. Don, let's jump back to the last. It's the PowerPoint available to public and to us, that, or will it be when it's finalized?
Will be.
Okay.
Good question. PowerPoint is in the summary and full final report.
Don, I've got a similar question. Did we allocate the funding in this budget to allow this presentation to be made elsewhere when it's final, to send it on the road and get to different audiences?
We did not budget any funding for that. We haven't typically done that. I think in the past, the reports from Sterling, they carried themselves, right? Being a little facetious there. We haven't budgeted any money to do that. However, we get invitations to present the results of the report, and I'm sure that will follow here as well.
Well, Laura just whispered in my ear and said, we could probably find some funding within the division. If folks think that's of value to make presentations and to have the company go and do that.
Okay.
I certainly believe it would be of value to make some presentations. However, the most important one would be to get these three summary reports together and present those to the legislature, because they actually have authority to make a change that can start helping the system rather than simply going on where it's at. So certainly going through policymakers would be the important one, and that could be for all three reports. So we present a summary of the entire information rather than just one of the reports, because I think that paints a broader picture. When you look at, we got a lot of lakes in this world that are drying out, they're saline, we have a cost associated with the lake drying, and we have a forecast that says it's only going to get worse unless we do something. So if you don't want these catastrophic costs to occur, we know that there are steps that can be taken to help mitigate. That's what we need to look at.
Let's look at that between now and the next meeting and come back with maybe a sure. plan to do so.
Certainly at the 2020 Great Salt Lake Issues Forum, this would be a part of the program that would be included. So just consider that as a venue at which this information could be shared as well.
Other comments? Recommendations or actions or comments from advisory council members? At our September 11 meeting, we will have the scenarios from the integrated water resource management model presentation. It's been suggested that we talk about the legislation. If you have any other recommendations or suggestions in the next few weeks, let me know and we'll start working on the agenda.
You know, one of the other things we might want to put on the agenda the next meeting is to discuss the use of the funds we have.
All right. Okay, other comments? Dan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I forgot to tell you that last session, Brian Cottam and Laura Alt and myself went up to the legislature and we got the money for the Phragmites to be put in the budget automatically. We don't have to go up and beg anymore.
Congratulations.
So that half a million's in there.
At a 500,000 level?
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe we can eradicate it.
One day at a time.
Well, time to spare. So let me ask one final question about venue. Would you like to hold the September 11 meeting here, or would you like to go back to the administration building? Dan?
I'd like to go out to Antelope Island.
Antelope Island?
Have good view of the desert.
Some past year.
It's a smaller room.
I like here.
Here's good. But the last time we went out there, there was a great big storm came through, and Don had to yell at everybody, and he felt pretty comfortable about doing it. So maybe we should go out there and let him yell at us again.
I don't remember that, Dan. The thunderstorm.
You blacked out after?
We erased it from the audio recording.
I would suggest that you're going to have it here to make sure everybody uses the mic. Right. Yeah.
That's the only problem with here is the volume of the sound and the potential for other internal sounds.
It's a nice venue.
This is nice. It is a nice venue, however.
Other than that, it's a great place.
Okay, other comments? Hearing none, I'll adjourn the meeting a few minutes early. And thank you so much for being here.
Dave? I'll have to get a picture of those cute little birds.
Yeah.
They are so cute.
Yes, almost all the shorebirds are just so fun to look at and watch. And so I planted drought resistant pasture grass in the back. Holy cow, that is so nice. It is so nice. I just tickled to death with that thing.
You know, they have all these nest cams, they call them, where you can, I think Cornell University puts them up and they have 8 or 10. And you can follow 24 hours a day inside the nest of kestrels, or they always have red box. They don't have too many shorebirds, but ospreys. I mean, basically, it's their entire life history that you can watch anytime you might just dial in. What's going on?
Have you been watching that Yellowstone live?
The witch?
Have you been watching Yellowstone live?
We saw part of one episode. Yeah.
I saw the part where they had a camera inside the beaver's den.
Oh, yeah.
Those things are so stinking cute. And 2 weeks after they're born, they're waterproof.
That's got to be recent news. Nobody knew what went on in this.
But it's just so cool. I just, wow.
Yeah.
It's really fun. Yeah. I like that. Beavers have always been kind of a cute animal.
Yeah.
Somebody said we had opossums in Utah.
There's gotta be somewhere. There'd be in peace.